This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will hear from Congressman Bill Cassidy, seeking a third term on Capitol Hill. The Republican from Baton Rouge will be in studio to talk with us about what's going on in Washington and on the home front. We will talk with Congressman Bill Cassidy. Also on the show, later in the hour, we will hear from Tiger Rag editor Cody Worsham on the arrests of four former LSU football players on marijuana charges, including the Honey Badger, Tyrann Mathieu, and former quarterback Jordan Jefferson. And neuropsychologist Darlene Nemeth from Baton Rouge. Her book is Living in an Environmentally Traumatized World. All this today, but first the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 877-217-5757 anywhere and 297-5633 locally. You may reach us online, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin with Congressman Bill Cassidy, Republican from Baton Rouge, a prominent physician in our community as well. He's still practicing medicine, and we will talk with him about what's going on with health care and much more as we move along this morning. Good morning, Congressman Cassidy.
Hey, Jim. Thank you for having me.
And you're seeking a third term. The election's 11 days away.
Yep, that's true. Both are.
and today we're doing the show in the Clerk of Court building on Corsi Boulevard. And all these people out here in the hallway, they must be all here to vote for you in early voting, right?
I sure hope so.
Well, we've had the congressman's opponents, Richard Torrigano and Rufus Craig, on this show. And the congressman, who was a former state senator, got started a bit later than many in politics, but now he's moved to the U.S. House of Representatives and seeking a third term in the U.S. House this November the 6th. For years, he was the lesser known of the Cassidy brothers. His brother Steve was a great LSU football player in the 1970s. What's your take on what's happening with the arrest of these four players?
If someone does something illegal, they should obviously be arrested. On the other hand, you want young people to be reformed, and so you hope that for people who have such potential in life that they are reformed. I'll probably limit my comments to that.
At the press club, I think you were asked about decriminalization of marijuana.
Yeah, it's about the only place I'm ever asked about it. It's kind of amusing. Everybody's talking about health care, the economy, jobs, infrastructure, Benghazi. It's only at the press club that people ask about legalization of pot. So, Jim, that may tell me something about the reporters. That's not an issue that's on people's mind. It's really not.
So you're not in favor?
No. Although what I am, clearly, there's in the role of federalism, I'm a Tenth Amendment guy. And right now you see a lot of states taking actions on that, which are, in fact, de facto decriminalization, in some cases, de facto legalization. As a Tenth Amendment fellow, in which states should have certain rights, I accept that.
Well, we're going to get to as many of you as possible, and I have several emails sent, and I also have some folks waiting online. And please be brief in your remarks. One of the emails refers to the Amendment 2, which is on the ballot, same day you are, that could expand gun rights in Louisiana. Are you a proponent?
You know, I don't think that it expands so much as protects. I have an A-plus rating from NRA. I'm a lifetime member of NRA. I've not read the amendments yet. I'll read them when I go in. But again, I'm an NRA. I'm a Second Amendment federal supporter. So when I look at this, I suspect I'll find that I support it.
Dorothy on Goodwood. Good morning, Dorothy. You're on with Congressman Cassidy. Please be brief.
Yes. Congressman Cassidy, I'd like to know what you have done in Congress besides vote no.
I think if you're in line right now, you're clearly not voting for me, Dorothy. I've done a heck of a lot in Congress, if I may say. We have actually, aside from the constituent service, which people here find very valuable, I think I've contributed in our committee hearings in which we have attempted to bring the federal government, the executive branch, to greater accountability, and have actually worked on significant issues such as Medicaid reform, which is, of course, of interest to our state and across the nation, influencing the debate on that, may I say, with another fellow who you'll apparently love, a liberal Democrat. And I say that not to be denigrating, Dorothy, because I think you'll take that as a badge of honor. Have started a dyslexia caucus trying to bring attention to an issue that affects the reading ability of maybe as many as 20% of our population. We're working on that to promote awareness and as well as to look to what can be done to improve opportunities for people with dyslexia. Dorothy, I thank you for the question, but if you want to log on our website, cassidy.house.gov, we can give you a more exhaustive list. And I think you'll read it and say, the guy, I may not agree with him, but the guy is working hard.
Now, another question online about your possible run in 2 years for the U.S. Senate. Is that a viable option?
Yeah, people are asking about running for Senate, which I think in some cases is curiosity. In other cases, it's dissatisfaction with the status quo. We're focused on what happens on November the 6th, number one. Number two, clearly, if we do poorly November the 6th, if we don't win, or if whatever their surprises, then it won't be an option. So serious people won't approach. So as it turns out, when you make such a decision like this, you take care of first things first. Then you speak to your wife and your children. And with that, in our family, we pray about such decisions. And then you talk to voters. You talk to serious people, grassroots folks. If that all comes together, then of course I would consider it. I'm an American. I would love to serve my country in that way. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen.
It sounds like it's something you're thinking about, though.
Again, after November the 6th, we will approach the decision.
Have you decided for whom you'll be voting for president?
Yeah, I'm voting for the guy who's pro-growth, who wants a sustainable health care system, and who believes in lower taxes. And there's only one candidate that believes in all of that, and that's Mitt Romney.
All right. What about mayor? Have you decided for whom
you'll be voting? I'm supporting Mike Walker.
Okay. Robbie Hogan, LSU political scientist, writes, Congressman, during this election cycle, many Republicans have much to say about rape. As a candidate for Congress, will you pledge to oppose any legislation that criminalizes abortion for rape victims?
You know, obviously there's been a lot of discussion about this. So let's just say a couple things right off the bat. That rape is a crime. It is a heinous crime, which no matter what is the product of that, the woman should be absolutely supported. And obviously, rape occurs to men. And so, indeed, whoever is the victim should be absolutely supported. Now, on the other hand, it's a complicated situation. There are women who bear that child. It is a child. And who end up loving that child or may give it up for adoption but feel good about that decision. So I'm not for criminalizing the woman's behavior, but nor am I in favor of saying, oh my gosh, this child is conceived through rape, so therefore abortion's okay.
So do you believe in an exception for rape?
No, my position is the life of the mother, exception for the life of the mother. Encouraging that woman with all the support that you can give her, that she bear that child, and if she doesn't wish to keep it, to put it up for adoption.
Okay, so no exceptions for you on that issue, which...
No, you just asked me. I said the life of the mother.
Absolutely. That's one that has been a given in most legislation.
But and by the way, let's just put this in perspective. No one is proposing, certainly not Mitt Romney, to criminalize this issue. This is an issue which has been kind of brought up as a way to kind of, get people like Todd Akin and Mr. Murdoch, I gather. I haven't followed that story, but I've seen the headlines. And so it's not anything that's imminent. It's not anything being proposed. It is something which is kind of being tossed out there as a thought experiment for folks like Todd Akin.
But if there is a change in the guard at the highest level of our government.
For what it's worth, Mitt Romney said he's not going to approach the issue.
But if he appoints a pro-life justice or two, then the court could swing to the point where Roe v. Wade could be overturned. And if that happens, would there be a revolution in this country, or would it just be a very quiet development?
You're asking kind of a hypothetical, but but Roe v. Wade doesn't. All Roe v. Wade does is it returns the issue to the states. And prior to Roe v. Wade, a lot of states had already effectively legalized abortion. Again, there's a lot of misunderstanding about the consequences of that law.
All right. Colonel Johnson asked if you signed Grover Norquist's anti-tax pledge.
Yeah, I have. I'm not in favor of raising taxes.
In any circumstances?
You want it to be... Now, if you say we're going to offset one increase and lower elsewhere, I think that's a reasonable thing to do. You want a pro-growth policy. You want something. People who think that we can tax our way into growth are wrong. And I think the whole point of that is to point out that we cannot tax our way into prosperity. We could confiscate the wealth of the top 1% of the people in the United States, and it would not affect our debt and deficit. On the other hand, we can promote pro-growth policies in which people are paying more taxes, not because rates go higher, but because they earn more money. And as they earn more money, they are more prosperous. That is the better way to go. Indeed, if you look at what the CEOs yesterday recommended, they recommended just such a policy, lowering the marginal tax rate, but limiting the deductions that may take place, basically saying we can address our debt and deficit with a pro-growth policy. I think most economists agree growth is the way out of this. If we want to tax just to raise taxes, well, that's something the president apparently wants to do because it offends him that some are doing better than others. I'm more about growth. I'm more about that middle-class family making more money than I am about, you know, doing something just because I'm offended by it.
297-5633 is your number if you'd like to engage Congressman Bill Cassidy. As you can hear, he's not a fan of President Obama. You've met the man, haven't you?
Yeah, I have met the man. Very pleasant meeting. I mean, it was brief, of course. He was working a line. But we shook hands, and, you know, I mentioned I was interested in health care, my background as a doctor caring for the uninsured, which I still do, as you mentioned. And he says, well, let's get in touch with me. I'm not an ideologue, is what I think I'm quoting him. I'd like to hear your ideas. So we sent our ideas, but, you know, it got filtered out, never heard back from him.
Well, you said and implied that he resents people who are doing well. Do you think that's the case?
When the president speaks about raising taxes, if you listen to him carefully, and you got to listen carefully, but he acknowledges that it will not address the debt. He says it's an issue of equality. Now, in a state like Louisiana, where there's a 6% marginal tax rate on upper-income people, the overall tax rate before employment tax is 41%. If you add employment tax, it goes up to something like 43 or 44. And so we may decide that 44% is not enough for someone to pay. But let me tell you, Jim, a couple of women I met the other week at the Better Business Bureau meeting, two women, and they have a business that relates to kitchen fixtures. I said, how's it going? They said, oh, it's been a rough patch. Tell me about it. We've been in business since the 80s. And we did well. We funded our retirement. So they've been in business for 30 years, which tells us that at least one of them is middle-aged. And we have taken out 50% of our retirement to get through this rough patch. But now we're doing better and we're hiring again. I'm thinking to myself, wow, when they were doing well, they socked away dollars. Now they're doing less well. So they're taking from their retirement, even in middle age, in order to get through a rough patch. And now they're hiring again. Let me ask you, what's better for growing jobs in Louisiana? Two women carefully managing their money so that in the fat years they do well, in the lean years they support themselves and now are growing again, are sending those tax dollars in their better-off years to Washington, D.C. for a Washington bureaucrat to decide where to spend. I would argue it's better for job growth here that those women manage their own money.
Joe downtown, please be brief. Joe, you're on with Congressman Cassidy.
Good morning. I have a question related to the tax issues, the tax cuts. It seems to me that when we talk about just general tax cuts to spur growth or create jobs, we're missing the fact that salary expense is deductible now. So a straight tax cut, you know, hiring somebody actually lowers your tax liability. And I never hear that addressed. And I'm just wondering, maybe we should, instead of just cutting rates, maybe we should make salaries deductible at some amount greater than 100%.
All right. Would you respond, Congressman?
Joe, you've obviously thought a lot about that, man, and I have not. So I'm going to defer on that a little bit. I will take the chance to point out in the paper today that that they said there's a consensus of leading economists that allowing the Bush tax cuts to expire would be very harmful to our economic growth. Now, I didn't read the article in depth because I was getting kids off to school, helping my wife in the kitchen, and getting ready to come here. But I presume that was both across the political spectrum, liberal and conservative. So I agree with you that what we do with our tax code is essential to how business grows. I have not thought about your specific concept.
297-5633, 877-217-5757. Congressman Bill Cassidy with us for another segment. He has a town hall meeting later today, and we will talk with him about his bid for a third term on Capitol Hill. He is a well-financed candidate expected to win re-election, and we will discuss with him what's happening in his district and in Louisiana after this one-minute pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Please make your remarks and questions brief for Congressman Cassidy. He'll be with us for another segment. Raul in on Corporate Boulevard. Raul, good morning. You're on with the Congressman.
Good morning, Congressman. Thank you for the opportunity. A quick question. I understand the politics of politics, and every party has their talking points, but it seems that it's misrepresented that the president really wants to do a balanced approach, and it's not only cutting taxes for the rich that's going to grow the economy, but it's also more of a moral thing where everybody's pitching in and they don't pitch in, and it's more of a balanced approach, cutting spending and raising taxes for those millionaires. So what's wrong with that approach?
Mm-hmm. Well, Raul, if that was his approach, maybe he could get more buy-in from me. But if you look at what his own debt commission said, the Simpson-Bowles Debt Commission said, the principal drivers of our national indebtedness is Medicare and Medicaid. Two important safety net programs. Again, I will be at Earl K. Long Hospital Monday and Tuesday seeing patients on Medicaid. So the president has not offered reform proposals for either. And in both cases, his actuaries say that Medicare is going bankrupt within 12 years, and they made that pronouncement after the president's health care law was passed. And as regards the equality issue, you know, there's some states with a top marginal tax rate like California of 11%. That means that with payroll tax and 35% federal tax and 11% California tax, they're paying, 45 to 50% of their marginal income. Now, maybe that's not enough. That's something to argue about. I would, though, say that dollars in the private sector are more likely to lead to economic growth. And again, if you listen carefully to the president, he's actually not going to use that money to pay down the debt. He's going to use it to pay for other spending, which avoids adding to the debt. That is an important distinction.
Reverend Randy in Zachary. Hi, Reverend Randy. You're on with Congressman Cassidy.
Congressman Cassidy, before the August recess, there were two votes I'd like to ask you about that you made. One of them was for removing, doing any tax reform, any credits for the working poor, and also taking away the home mortgage interest deduction for the middle class. I'd like to know, how could you explain that to us? People like me that are working people who are not wealthy and use those deductions to advance our causes and to take care of our family.
Reverend, I'm not quite sure what vote you're talking about. It may have been a Democratic motion to recommit, which are often kind of irresponsible bills that are supposed to create talking points. I am all for strengthening the middle class and have never voted. I'm not quite sure the bills that you're referring to. But if you get back in touch with our office, let me know about that. I'm sorry. I'm just not quite sure where you're going with that, and that's not really consistent with where my votes have been in the past. So, again, it may have been some off vote designed merely to embarrass, but it wasn't an important, substantial policy issue.
All right. An email from station manager at WRKF, David Gordon. He says, Congressman Cassidy has said he would vote to end funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Ending federal funding would mean WRKF would lose about $108,000 a year. What are your thoughts regarding the possibility of this, and would you be in favor of stations competing on a level playing field with commercial stations?
You know, David, I don't know that last. I don't know the uneven playing field between public radio and commercial. I don't know that, but I tend to promote freedom. And so if we're going to restrict what you get from the taxpayer, then I would be interested in looking at other reforms. I will also point out that it's an important issue, I suppose, but it is only something I hear at the press club. And to put the issue in perspective, our country right now borrows 42% of everything that we spend. And under President Obama's budgets, it worsens so that the percent of debt to our gross domestic product eventually will be 100%. By 2030, 18 years from now, 100% of our federal tax revenue will go to interest on the debt, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. There'll be nothing for defense, nothing for roads, nothing for levies, education, research, you name it, it's not there except for those big four. So that said, our country has to make some really important decisions. How do we pare our budget just like a family does when a family's having tight dollars? And there may be some good things, even things that I appreciate and occasionally contribute to, like Corporation for Public Broadcasting, that can no longer get federal support. It's what any family does. They sit around the kitchen table. They say, well, we can afford this. We can't afford that. It's really wonderful. We just can't afford it. And they make that decision. I think we're at that point with some really we're at that point in our country's history.
Now, this is about 1/100th of the federal budget. What other cuts would you specify?
You know, I'm always amused, by the way. Only in government will we say that $355 million a year is not very much money. I always try and put that into how many households in Ascension, Livingston, EBR, Iberville, West. But you go down through my district that I represent, St. Helena. How many households would pay all year long just to make up $355 million? It'd be a lot. Maybe all of them. So one, it's still a lot of money, even if it's only a small percent. But secondly, what did President Obama's bipartisan debt commission say we've got to control? Healthcare entitlements. That's what this national debate really should be about. How do we preserve these important safety net programs that I know from personal experience are so important to ensure the health of folks, our neighbors, our mothers, our parents, sometimes us ourselves, we ourselves? How do we preserve those and at the same time make them sustainable? I was at Assumption General Hospital yesterday, and the director of the hospital that's affiliated with the Lady of the Lake quoted one of the nuns. He said, without money, there is no mission. If you can't fiscally sustain a healthcare system, you cannot sustain healthcare. Right now, we have programs which are fiscally unsustainable. I would start with reform proposals for those that would both help sustain them, improve patient outcomes, but also contribute to lowering our national indebtedness.
Is there one program, though? We know you don't like public broadcasting, where you say you like public broadcasting. We've got to get rid of that. We just shouldn't be paying the freight.
I don't think you're listening to what I'm saying, Jim. What I'm saying is the biggest cost drivers in our national indebtedness are what the president's bipartisan debt commission calls healthcare entitlements. Now, if we can reform those, maybe you can keep your money for Corporation of Public Broadcasting. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Are we going to get rid of Medicare?
Again, you're not listening to what I'm saying. These are my patients. We have to reform the program so it continues to provide those safety net benefits, but which is sustainable. Now, Romney has put forward such a plan. Actually, Ryan has, but it was actually John Breaux's plan. And John Breaux and Bob Kerry, both centrist Democrats, along with Ron Wyden, a liberal Democrat, and Paul Ryan, three of the four have been Democrats, have come up with a plan that keeps Medicare exactly as it is for those who are 65 and above, exactly as it is for those 55 and above, i.e., if you get on Medicare in 10 years, it's the same program. But if you're 54 and below, it changes to something called premium support. John Breaux, still in concept, agrees with it, as do many other prominent Democrats, and the president's demagogue in it is irresponsible. It takes 30 years to fix the problem. I'm thinking, wow, it doesn't change anything for 10 years, and it takes 30 years to fix the indebtedness, and this is a radical solution endorsed by multiple Democrats? So this actually can address our debt and deficit. I wish the president were more responsible. I wish he wasn't demagoguing this bipartisan plan.
Are there any areas in the defense budget that you would recommend for cutting?
Yeah, that's not my committee of jurisdiction, but anytime you have a program that big, there's going to be something which is wasteful. I'll say that Alan West, who is a retired colonel from the Army, says that there are programs that he would cut. Again, that's not my committee of jurisdiction. So if that time comes, I would go to someone like Colonel West and others, excuse me, and ask them their thoughts.
You'd keep the bayonets, though.
Yeah, the president actually, obviously you're alluding to what the president said the other night. Apparently the Marines still use bayonets.
And lots of them, yeah.
And apparently the Navy still needs more ships. So I don't think the president did a service to the American people by a sarcasm the other night.
Okay. Sharon in Prairieville, good morning. You're on with Congressman Bill Cassidy.
Hi, hey, Sharon. Tom. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And I want to congratulate you on the way that you dodge answering questions. But what I want to say is, I am resentful and offended to call Social Security an entitlement. That's like telling me that my milk and bread are an entitlement.
So, all right. Would you respond? Thank you, Sharon.
Sharon, I'm not sure where you're coming from, sister. And I don't mean to offend you by calling you sister. I apologize that. And I don't think I'm dodging anything. I'm running straight at it. The fact is, the president's bipartisan debt commission, the president, President Obama's bipartisan debt commission calls it an entitlement. President Obama's administration calls them entitlements. Now, you may want me to use a different vocabulary than the president, but it kind of puts us on common ground. I think what you're, though, drawing a distinction between is between earned entitlements, things that we pay into our whole life, like Medicare and Social Security, and entitlements that are given to us just because we happen to live in the United States of America. That would include food stamps. And I actually agree with that distinction, Sharon. I think you and I have, once we move beyond the vocabulary issue, we have common ground. And I do think that earned entitlements like Medicare and Social Security are a contract with the American people, with their government. They have paid into them, and that's why I'm so committed to supporting and preserving and strengthening them. So again, if you can forgive me on the vocabulary and listen to a transcript of this, you'll see I'm not dodging. I'm running straight at it. And I'm using the vocabulary of President Obama. You'll see that I make a distinction between earned and, if you will, unearned. And I am thoroughly in favor of supporting that contract for those earned entitlements.
The Public Affairs Research Council has urged LSU and the Jindal administration to slow down efforts to downsize the state's public hospital system and rely more heavily on the private sector. Your thoughts?
I don't know the numbers to that. Clearly, again, I work at Earl K. Long. I keep saying that, but I think it's pertinent to repeat it. When I walked out from doing liver biopsies on Monday, I asked the nurses, are we still going to be here? And it was tongue-in-cheek, but they knew what I was saying. But you got to know the numbers. And you have to know how much money the state has from Medicaid, and you have to know to the degree to which they can support whatever they have. I think it's important to point out, though, clearly Medicaid is an unsustainable program in its current form. And the president's health care law actually expands a program which is currently unsustainable. Under the president's health care law, we'll go from 20% of people in Louisiana being on Medicaid to 40% of people in Louisiana being on Medicaid. This is a program that we're already having to cut back because we can't sustain it. Go back to what that nun said. If there is no mission, there is no if there is no money, there is no mission. Anything like that has to be fiscally sustainable. And I say that as a guy who's committed my life to working in that system. We just need to make it fiscally sustainable.
Steve in Brobridge. Hi, Steve. You're on with Congressman Bill Cassidy.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Cassidy?
Hey, Steve.
Congressman Cassidy and Jim. Congressman Cassidy, I have a question for you. I want to know, why didn't Congress do more to create jobs and help the president rather than fight against him? I take my ass off there.
Man, Steve, I tell you, buddy, the House Republicans have passed 30-something bills trying to promote job creation, which have died on Harry Reid's desk. Example, we have promoted the building of the Keystone XL pipeline, taking Canadian oil, creating 20,000 jobs directly, construction jobs to build that pipeline down to the Gulf Coast, and then 100,000 jobs kind of indirectly, if you will, you know, for carpenters and for restaurant workers and for car dealers, that sort of thing. And we'd send a bill like that over to Harry Reid, but because it doesn't agree with the president's agenda, Reid doesn't take it up on the Senate side. 30 bills like that, which would have created good working class, middle class jobs, dying on Reid's desk. I wish Harry Reid were here to give his side of the story, but the fact is we've done our darndest, but the way our founding fathers set this system up, we got to get something through both chambers, and the Senate has not wanted to work with us.
Gus on Goodwood, please be brief. Hi, Gus, you're on.
Hi. A big deal has been made about Big Bird and Sesame Street and NPR and PBS. And frankly, I don't support the idea that our taxes should be funding left-leaning or propagandist enterprises like PBS and NPR. I don't think our taxes should be done with that.
All right. I think you would get an argument that Big Bird is left-leaning, but
You can say that if you listen to public radio during the day, Tavis Smiley definitely has a perspective. And so as one
he's
example.
He's only on a minority of stations.
Well, he's on this station. I don't know, but I've heard he's not on anymore, but he used to be.
But yeah. Go ahead.
So, but on the other hand, wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to worry about that? If we could say to Gus and to me and to others, listen, your tax dollars aren't there, so they can show whatever they want. So just like J-Bo has a certain perspective and 107.3 does, et cetera, so does NPR. But your tax dollars aren't there, so you can choose to listen to it or not. I think Gus makes an important point.
But, for example, if you're advertising on a radio station and you're running for Congress, say if you're on a commercial station, you can run a spot saying, vote for Bill Cassidy, I've done this, that, and the other, and I'm fighting for the people, and I'm your man in Washington. But if you're on public radio, it's paid for by Bill Cassidy. The question from Mr. Gordon earlier is, what would you say if public radio were allowed to do the same thing that commercial stations do?
Well, what we're really saying is, what if public radio were no longer public radio, but rather commercial radio? And so if it becomes commercial radio, and again, I don't know this issue, but I think I understand a little bit more where you're coming from. If it becomes commercial radio like the others, it can do whatever it wants.
All right. Dan downtown, please be brief. Hi, Dan. You're on with the congressman. Dan, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, Dan.
Yes, hi. Do you think that some in Congress are demagoguing with regard to freedom of speech afforded by the Citizens United case, when actually, unless you have a highly paid lobbyist, you have less freedom of speech?
I'm not sure I agree with the premise of that. Obviously, labor unions for the longest time had the ability to weigh in elections, and so they were actually exempt. I think some of the discussion is that Citizens United allows businesses and individuals the same sort of ability to advertise as a third party as unions have always enjoyed. But unions are clearly a corporate entity, if you will. A lot of individuals pool their dollars in order to advertise. So, although Dan, it looks like you sounds like you've really looked into this, I'm not sure I agree with the original premise of your argument.
Did you think the Citizens United was a good decision?
You know, I'm not an attorney, so I won't comment on that, but I will notice George Will's point is well taken. How many elections has third-party money actually influenced so far? We've had two incumbents lose. Most people would say if you have incumbents more endangered, that's a good thing. Two incumbents who are thought mm-hmm. to have lost because of that particular program. So it may have actually increased the turnover in Congress, if you will.
Final call, Debbie downtown. Please be brief. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I just wanted to tell the congressman, as far as I'm concerned, he's discredited himself because Alan West, with all the crazy comments he's been making, I don't think why anybody would listen to anything that he has to say about the military or anything else. And I'll take my comments off the air.
So, Debbie, I take it you don't like Colonel West. And I don't know if you may be a conservative or a liberal, but it's kind of the ironic thing is liberals don't like Alan West, period. But that said, Alan West is saying there's things in the military that he would cut, which typically liberals like. So sometimes you may not like the messenger, but there may be a message within that that the messenger gives that there's more than one message the messenger gives. So if you listen to what he says, and again, I don't know if you're liberal or not, but just because liberals often want to cut the military, they may have some common ground with Colonel West on this one.
We're going to pause and return for just a few moments with the congressman and let him get to his town hall meeting. He's been gracious. He's gotten quite a workout this morning, 297-5633. We'll also hear from Cody Worsham of Tiger Rag on the arrests of four former LSU football players and Darlene Namath on her role in this community and her book as a prominent neuropsychologist. All this coming, but first, this one-minute timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, wrapping it up with Congressman Bill Cassidy. Now, you are headed for a town hall meeting, so folks who didn't get through to you today on this show, they can see you in about an hour in Denham Springs?
Yes, Pete's Highway, La Plantation Retirement Community from 10:30 to noon.
10:30 to noon. So the congressman, and I must say, you're running against two candidates who don't have money and don't have much name recognition, but you were brave enough to debate them at the press club, and I commend you for doing that, and you're making appearances like this, so hats off to you for facing the public. Some folks would not do that.
Well, the election time is when you face the public, and we actually, people may disagree with me, but I think we should be proud of what we've done in our office.
All right, and here's an easy one from Jim Kleinpeter of the Picayune. He says, Congressman Cassidy, tell us about that pick six versus Lake Charles in the 1974 playoff.
I actually scored two touchdowns. Now, thank you, Jim, for allowing me to brag about something which no one else ever remembers. They remember my brother, Steve. They know my wife, Laura, the breast cancer surgeon. I did score two touchdowns. I got a question for Jim. How come he doesn't have any, for Jim Kleinpeter, how come he doesn't have any gray hair on that billboard on the Times Pick thing? So anyway, we're the same age and I have lots of gray hair. Well, so,
well, Jim's in good shape and so are you. So you must be using that house gym quite regularly.
No, actually, I'm wearing looser clothes.
Well, thank you, Congressman, and good luck on this campaign and perhaps a run for the U.S. Senate is in the offing from the man from Baton Rouge by way of Illinois. Congressman Bill Cassidy. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Thank you. Cody Worsham is here with us, the editor of Tiger Rag, and it's been impossible to miss stories emanating from the campus of LSU or near campus on West State Street, where four former LSU football players, including the Honey Badger, Tyrann Mathieu, and Jordan Jefferson, the beleaguered quarterback of a year ago, were placed in police cars and hauled off to the jailhouse, and they've been charged with drug possession. What do you think, Cody Worsham?
Well, that's correct. Jefferson and Mathieu both have simple possession charges, first offense. The other two players were Carnell Hatcher and Derek Bryant. Hatcher is a second offense, and Bryant was charged with intent to distribute. So from what I'm hearing, Mathieu and Jefferson may be okay legally, but those other two guys have a little bit of a battle to fight.
The Honey Badger just can't stay out of trouble, can he?
No, he can't. You know, he talked about how he was surrounding himself with better people and distancing himself from that life, and clearly he hasn't. It remains to be seen, you know, whether this will get his life back on track, but, you know, this is strike three for him, in my opinion.
297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and our Moments with Cody Worsham, editor of Tiger Rag. The Reveille yesterday covered this story, as you might expect. It happened literally a stone's throw from campus, and it happened when Jordan Jefferson allegedly had some trouble getting into an apartment house?
That's correct, and it was actually the second time in a couple of days that he's tried to get into that apartment complex. I believe it's the campus crossing at North Gates. It's a gated area. And apparently this was the second time in several days that Jefferson had tried to gain access into the gates. And a security officer yesterday around 3:30 confronted him about trying to get in through the gate without proper authority. And there was a scene. Jefferson left the scene and entered apartment 2116 where Mathieu was. And that's when the apartment owner called the cops, asked them to come look into it. They knocked on Matthew's door, opened the door, and smelled marijuana, asked if they could search the apartment. They did, and that's where it went from there.
Well, today it's front page news all over the state, and curiously, the Baton Rouge Advocate has the story above the fold, and then at the bottom it talks about the bar hours being extended. Bar owners look forward to Sunday sales. And a comment from Lulu Lewis, a waitron at Louie's this morning, was that these guys, you would have thought they were running a meth lab. Oh, what's the big deal about this particular charge?
Well, the big deal is like I said, the sources that I have are telling me that in Mathieu and Jefferson's case, they may be okay legally, but when the cops searched the apartment, they found 10 bags of quote-unquote high-grade marijuana, as well as a marijuana scale and shaver. And it was very clear that seven of those bags were found in Bryant's backpack, which is why they charged him with intent to distribute. So that's a lot of marijuana to have, and the intent to distribute charge is what's going to be dangerous for him.
Carmen in Prairieville. Good morning, Carmen. You're on the air with Cody Worsham.
Hi, Jim. I'm just a little upset about this because Jefferson and the Honey Badger hat were charged with simple possession. Anybody else who weren't LSU football players would have been given a summons. But yet they were arrested and put on TV for this. I mean, I just didn't want to hear your thoughts on that because most people would have just got a summons for that.
Well, yeah, and it's also true, Carmen, that Hatcher and Brian have apparently been arrested before. Well,
yeah, Hatcher has a prior charge of possession, and I'm not sure about Bryant.
And I wonder if this occurred when they were football players at LSU.
Yeah, that's something to look into.
Well, it is no doubt piling on Jefferson and Matthew, no doubt about it. And these young men have a chance to have successful lives. Both of them are young. Jefferson's still, what, just 21, I think.
That's true.
And Matthew is 20 years old. But this seems to be something that make it very difficult for them to be successful in this community. If they're applying for a job, and in Matthew's case, he still has hopes of playing in the NFL. What about him playing at LSU? Is that going to happen again?
I think this is just about puts an end to all that talk. The sources that I have inside the LSU football operations building, some of them are actually, I wouldn't say relieved, but they are quite certain that Matthew will not try to make his way back on the team, and that's a fact that they're comfortable with, because to be quite honest, they're tired of dealing with things like this and having to associate themselves with this sort of behavior.
Well, these guys are not on the team, and Les Miles says he really can't comment because it's obviously going to go through the legal process. But he said, quote, "It's a shame. Is this any kind of a distraction as LSU prepares for number one Alabama a week from tomorrow?"
I don't think inside the building it'll be a distraction. I think those guys are a tight-knit bunch. And I mean, if there's anything that would get them focused, it's Alabama coming to town. So I think all the outside stuff is stuff for the fans and the media to look into. But I think as far as the players are, it's barely a glitch on the radar.
Well, another headline, front page of the Reveille, arrest, another blow to LSU reputation. Is it a big blow to the reputation?
Definitely. I mean, it was a lead story on SportsCenter this morning with, you know, game two of the World Series just finishing yesterday. So people around the country are talking about this, and it's certainly not good for the LSU brand, especially with the fight last year at Shady's, Matthew's dismissal, Matthew being on the cover of Sports Illustrated this week. It's just a perfect storm for bad publicity.
All right. Well, thank you, Cody Worsham. We'll follow the story, and Cody is editor of Tiger Rag and TigerRag.com. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we're joined now by a prominent neuropsychologist in our community who has written a provocative book, Dr. Darlene Nemeth. It's spelled N-E-M-E-T-H, but it's pronounced like Broadway Joe, isn't it?
Exactly.
You're going to have to get close to the microphone, so...
It's pronounced exactly like Broadway Joe.
Number 12, the man who led the New York Football Jets to the world title on January 12, 1969 in Miami, Florida, 16-7 over the Baltimore Colts at the Orange Bowl, Super Bowl number 3. What about living in an environmentally traumatized world? That's the book from Dr. Nemeth. This is a big subject.
Oh, yes, it is. And my interest in it really started in the 80s when I worked on the Livingston Parish train derailment. And since that time, I have been working in the area of environmental trauma, and especially our big area of input came from Hurricane Katrina. And we finally have been able to see that there are three types of environmental trauma. One, just basically natural. Another, unfortunately, human-induced, and the third is a combination of both. And Katrina was a combination of both, and that's what made it so painful.
What's a human-induced environmental trauma?
A human-induced environmental trauma might be something like Three Mile Island, for example, something that was totally caused by that. Or, in many respects, when the big dam was built, the Hoover Dam. Okay, it created, there was, the dam was so heavy, the water was so heavy, that it created earthquakes in that area. And that was the fault of the people who developed it and constructed it.
Well, how do people generally respond to these kinds of traumas? Is the reaction immediate, or sometimes does it take time to absorb this?
It does take time to absorb it. When an environmental trauma hits, regardless of the etiology, the first thing is that people go into shock. And that takes quite a while sometimes to endure. Then, of course, the next thing is to try to survive. And after that, people have to assess what their basic needs are, and that's frequently when healthcare professionals come in and help with that, doctors, nurses, psychologists, etc. Then after that, there is an awareness of loss. And what we have recently learned is that when a person of importance comes in to almost bless their pain, like what happened in Fukushima, where the emperor came in and said that he was so sorry for what had happened, then people can begin to grieve. But unfortunately, they don't have much time, because right after that comes the spin and fraud. You know, and that's on both sides, spin and fraud. It's a very dangerous part. And then
what is spin and fraud?
Well, everybody wants you to see it through their eyes. If it's a company, they want to spin it a certain way, like the BP oil spill. Fraud is people I know from currently are a sinkhole trauma here near Bayou Corn. People are coming from all over claiming they live there when they don't, because they want to get money. And then after that, you have to really dig in and find out what's real and come to resolution so that you can move forward.
Well, if somebody experiences one of these traumas, tragedies, and they're trying to function in their jobs and with their loved ones, and they're carrying around this emotional baggage, how does it affect them?
It affects them very deeply, but people do not have to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. If you get in there with psychological first aid, they can be helped to face their feelings and share their experiences. They can be acknowledged and affirmed. Then they can begin solving their own problems. That's what we did in our Hurricane Katrina wellness workshops, is we allowed people to resolve their pain so they could begin thinking and solving their problems. Because thinking in the shadow of feelings doesn't work. You have to get the feelings out. So then when they start solving their problems, they can reassess things, reprioritize things, and they can really implement change, because the people who suffer are the people who need to deal with it. Things happen to a community and must be resolved by that community.
297-5633 is your number in our remaining moments with Dr. Darlene Namath. She is a neuropsychologist, practices here in Baton Rouge. How long have you been in practice?
35 years, Jim.
35 years. That's quite an investment.
Oh, yes.
And I imagine this field has progressed significantly over that time.
At one time, we didn't even know what eco-psychology was. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to people that the environment required psychological understanding and implementation. In fact, my friend Dr. Yasuo Onishi, who was the only non-Russian scientist allowed in the cleanup of Chernobyl, mm-hmm. he's now, because he's Japanese-American, working on Fukushima. Basically, he said in Chernobyl that the most lasting consequence of Chernobyl was psychological.
But in your case, are most of your patients people who have experienced some kind of physical trauma, like a car wreck or something along those lines?
Well, I am the director of neuropsychology at Sage Rehabilitation Hospital, and there it's usually physical trauma of some sort. Okay, but this doesn't necessarily have to reach the proportion of somebody coming into a psychologist's office for treatment. If the psychologists go there and do the group interventions to the communities that are needed, they can be spared the development of post-traumatic stress disorder.
The book is Living in an Environmentally Traumatized World, from Dr. Darlene Namath, who calls Baton Rouge home. And you deal also with marital therapy, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. How does that relate to neuropsychology?
Well, Jim, I'm a jack of all trades from the standpoint that I'm a clinical psychologist, a medical psychologist, and a neuropsychologist.
And your co-author, or one of them, is Dr. Judy Kuryansky. Now, I remember years ago, one of my colleagues in New Orleans, Ron Hunter, was hosting a radio show, and she was a guest, and Ron's wife called. And Judy said that she needed to do something to get Ron's attention. And then that night, Mrs. Hunter killed herself. This is a tough field at times, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Judy is a very famous media psychologist, and she's a professor at Columbia University. But as we know, that is not a good way to get people's attention.
No. There are a lot of ways to do it, including calling a radio show, which she did. That's the first thing she did. But to take one's life is not a good way to react.
In Louisiana, we have the phone, which is a godsend. It really, really helps. And as you know, it was created out of many tragedies at LSU.
And the phone started, what, late 70s, I believe.
Yes, yes.
And it is still active and going?
Very good. Very good source of crisis intervention. We are so fortunate as a community to have the phone.
Well, what about finally the survivor trauma? How does this relate to your research on this particular subject?
Well, it's very interesting because there are several steps to surviving. First of all, you have to be able to cope with what's going on. Most people, thank God, are very resilient. We can endure a lot. We must, though, develop a meaningful perspective, gain a sense of hope, and then come up with action, and action that is based on a holistic approach, not piecemeal.
Well, thank you, Dr. Darlene Nemeth, N-E-M-E-T-H, Living in an Environmentally Traumatized World. We hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back next week. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.